Hey, men, welcome back. Welcome to our weekly podcast for Morningstar Men. We're in a series now entitled I'm Not Ashamed of the Gospel, and this is the second week in that series. Before I introduce the series or the topic for the morning, I'd like to share with you again about our coming Manly Men evening, September the 26th, beginning at 6 o'clock in the evening. And this is the kickoff for an eight-week study series entitled Manly Men. Now, rather than just meeting on Saturday mornings, we're going to have groups meeting in homes, meeting in diners, around the area, everywhere where there are Morningstar guys or where Morningstar guys could convene, we're going to try to have a group. The groups are not only going to consist of guys in our church, but also friends, neighbors, anyone who has any interest in exploring some of the topics of what it means to be a truly genuine manly man. So look for more information, check the bulletin, check the church website. You're going to hear a lot about that in the next couple of weeks. All right, now back to our intro to the second week in I Am Not Ashamed. This week we're going to explore the method of the gospel. Last week we looked at the message of the gospel. What is the overall message that Jesus presented to his followers, that Paul presented to those as he taught? What is the authentic message of the gospel as God intends us to understand it, rather than perhaps how it has at times been a little bit twisted or distorted or mistaught? So last week we looked at that. This week we're going to look at the method of the gospel. Exactly how is this all carried out? You're going to hear a series of R words used this morning. Listen for them specifically, because they unfold the story for us of exactly how the gospel impacts us, how it connects with us, and how it transforms us. All right, guys, hope this is a blessing to you. Look forward to meeting with you again next week. All right. Can I begin now?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. So anyway, while we're not looking exclusively at Paul's story, we're evaluating or examining some elements of his personal life, and we're using them to understand what he means by, I am not ashamed of the gospel and the power that it has. Why does he make that statement? And we're looking at this in four components. Last week we looked at the message of the gospel. This week we're going to look at the method of the gospel. Next week we look at the power of the gospel. And finally the promise of the gospel. Alright, so Paul's opening statement that we use, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to Jews first and also to Greeks. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith, for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. So we're going to spend some time this morning looking at what faith really is. The word faith is thrown around an awful lot, but we can have some misunderstandings about what faith is. But to catch us all up on what we covered last week, remember one of the challenges that we said is that if something is 100% true and 100% predictable, it's easy to believe, it's easy to buy into, and it's easy to live by. If something is obviously, patently false, and we know that we can never rely on it, well, then we can dismiss it. The challenge when it comes to relating to God is that God is sometimes so misunderstood or so difficult to understand that we're never sure what to expect, and because of that, for some of us, there's a real challenge. We've already talked about the word faith. It's easy to believe in what you understand. Here's the first question.
Do you really think he's that understand, or I just don't like what he has to say?
Well, at times that's true. But at times, if we're honest, who hasn't said this? Who hasn't prayed this prayer? Please heal so-and-so. Please fix this problem. Please that. And then who hasn't stood back and watched and then posed this question? God, if you were God, why did you allow that? Because it sure seems like it would be easier for people to believe in you if you had done it a different way. Is there a person in this room who hasn't at least thought that, if not uttered it out loud? In other words, if I were in charge of the universe, I would certainly have done it in a different way, and it seems as if, at least from my vantage point, it seems as if it would have been easier for everybody to believe in God. And so I say, for that reason only, that I think from our vantage point, we sometimes struggle to understand what God is up to or why He does things the way He does, and therefore at times it presents challenges to our faith.
The two go together. I don't understand it. Why? Because I don't like it. I choose not to understand it. I don't like it. I'm not going to look for the reasons. I'm no longer looking for the reasons. I no longer care because I don't like it.
Well, but we know that there are those whose sole opposition to God and to the message of the gospel is that there is so much evil in the world. We know that there are those who have been believers who abandon their faith because of some bad or multiple bad experiences in their lives, and they just, you know what, this can't be true. And I don't even want to suppose that they've just decided randomly one day, I don't want to believe. I think they legitimately struggle to find comprehensible, understandable reasons to believe. And so they walk away. And so the challenge that each of us has is, how do we place, and what we're, I'm going to use the word now and then we're going to unpack it later, how do we place a living faith in a God who is sometimes difficult to understand? Okay, so the next component of this gospel message that we looked at is we got to start at the beginning. That if I don't understand the story from the beginning, I can be very confused by it. The other night, Scott handed me a little card. It was like the modern day version of a tract, and it starts out with this thing where you put your thumb on this little box in the front of the card, and you're supposed to hold it there for exactly 15 seconds, and then if it doesn't turn a bright green, you're not a good person, and then you flip it over on the back. And I took the time later on to carefully read the back of the card, where it unpacks the idea that, well, if the light didn't turn, or if the car didn't turn a bright green color there, that you're obviously not a good person and you're just like everybody else. And then it launches into the, what I'll call the predictable gospel message. The predictable gospel message that defines good according to the Ten Commandments, then defines God as the just judge of the Ten Commandments, and moves into the fact that then you're clearly separated from God, you fall under the judgment of God, and you know the rest of the story. But at every step in that explanation, it begs the question, says who? And that's the reality that many people begin with, says who? And so Paul, immediately after he says that he is not ashamed of the power of the gospel, takes everyone who is willing to listen directly back to the origins of the universe and says, in the beginning, essentially, God created and there is evidence for God. And so that's where we have to go. It doesn't do any good to start the message of the gospel with the statement, wouldn't you really like to avoid hell? Wouldn't you really like to go to heaven? Because the obvious question today is, who says there is either? It's not a very good place to begin anymore. It might have been a good place to begin at some point in our history, but it's no longer a valid place to begin. We have to begin the story at the beginning if anyone is ever to appreciate it. And incidentally, everyone has different questions about the story. So in the men's team meeting the other day, we discussed something that we'll just do a quick review. It's these concentric circles. Let's see if I can get them right. So on the outside, we have people who are outside the church. They have no interest in church. They have no interest in God. And then inside the next circle are people who have entered the church. They're exploring God. They haven't necessarily made any firm commitment or belief in God or anything like that, but they're exploring God. Then at some point in time, they make a commitment to become followers of Christ. They don't really completely understand all that, but they've made some commitment. And then inside that are people who are starting to align the practices and the processes of their life with the following of Christ. And then at the very center are those who gradually come to the point where they filter every decision through what would a Christ follower do, what would I as a Christ follower do. And then we said that each one of these represents a threshold that somebody has to cross. This is where I start to scribble over the board uncontrollably, so I have to step away from the board. So every one of these circles represents a threshold that an individual has to cross, and every one of these circles represents a barrier that prevents him from crossing. So unless I answer the question, or unless the question is satisfactorily answered that is preventing him from moving from this side of the threshold to that, he's not going to move. So our job is gradually to address those questions. And we all have them. I don't know which is more unsatisfactory, the eraser or the marker that I used, but there's certainly some evidence of the marking, isn't there? Well, anyway, so we need to begin in this presentation of a message at whatever level a person is. And unfortunately, most gospel presentations, if we want to talk about the message, begin somewhere in an inner circle. They make assumptions about the audience that are probably not true. All right. We said finally that the message of the gospel is an invitation not primarily to get something or avoid something, but it's what? What is the real good news of the gospel? I mean, is it like a free one-way ticket to an extended island cruise, essentially, that lasts forever? Or is it something other than that? Because I'm telling you, I've been to places, the best places. But if you're at the right place with the wrong people, it's still not a very happy time. Would you agree? What is the message, the real attraction of the gospel?
To be part of something bigger.
To be part of something bigger. To be reconnected with God. At its heart, the gospel is always relational. So it invites us to restoration with God. You can see the challenges that that presents. First, a person has to believe there is a God. First, they have to believe that they're out of relationship with God. First, they have to believe that there could be a relationship with God. So right there, there are a number of potential threshold barriers. But it's also an invitation to be rightly related to each other. So we said last week, imagine a relationship in your life that is severely broken. And you hurt because of that relationship. I mean emotionally, I don't mean physically. You ache because of that relationship because it's broken. The invitation of the gospel is an invitation to restoration of relationships. And we've already covered this in the past, but what are the things? We've defined this as an individual spiritual life. An individual spiritual life is how he is related to, gentlemen, the inner man is related to his world, the created world, that's one. Now that Jim jump-started us here, what's next?
We're going back to
I like to think that things stick in a person's mind. At least that's the imagination that I have within my own distorted reality. Okay, so...
Can you repeat the question? I was writing down what you previously said.
Oh, that's a nice segue, too. Yes. Okay. So what are the four components that my inner man is related to which define my spiritual life?
Each other.
Okay.
The world, each other.
Yep.
To God.
And finally to myself. That my relationship, even with myself, is damaged. So those are the four components. Those are the four elements that the gospel message invites us into healing with. Restoration of a relationship with God. Restoration of relationships with other humans, restoration and a proper understanding of our relationship to the created world, and finally, restoration of our relationship to ourselves. We'll look at that a little bit more today. All right. So enough about last week, enough about the message or the invitation. Now let's get into the method. How does the gospel actually do this? So at the top of your page there, there's five words, and I'd like you to add an additional word to it, and it's not really a proper word, but we're just going to add the word refill under repurpose. I've kept them all R words because in light of what I just discovered about how short your memory is, I don't know why I should even believe that you would remember these, but Hope springs eternal, does it not? So these are the methods, if you will, the gospel reaches, reconciles, restores, refines, repurposes, and refills. So in order to understand that at least a little bit, let's first read this verse together. For by grace you have been saved through faith. You can underline that. That word keeps coming up. So we're not going to delay beyond today in explaining that. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not of your own doing. It is a gift from God. So now let's turn over to Luke, the 15th chapter. So we know the story. But I want us to look at the story through these R words. All right, so we'll start at the beginning of the chapter. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, him being Jesus, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable. So here's the deal. We've got the people who are in power, and they don't quite understand why Jesus is associating with this particular crowd of people. Incidentally, here is another message of the gospel that we talked about last week. Who is the gospel for?
Everyone.
The gospel is for everyone. And we said it last week like this. You can't be too religious. In other words, there's no such thing as being too good to offend God. Believe me, there are people that I've met that I'd almost think that they are. You can't be too religious to be out of God's reach. You can't be too wicked to be out of God's reach. But here's a different way of understanding. The gospel is for people like us. The gospel is for people who are not like us. And finally, and this is perhaps the most offensive, the gospel is for people that we don't even like. Right? And isn't that the most troubling? So the gospel is for people who are like us, the gospel is for people who are not like us, and the gospel is for people whom we don't even like. Okay. Truthful question, truthful answers required. Is there a person whom in your own mind you think, boy, I hope they never hear, because I'm not sure I could stomach spending eternity with them. I'm not sure I could stomach having them show up at my church. Well, that's where these guys are right now. They're really hung up on this. It's not just that they're judging. Yes, they are judging. But it's more than they're judging. Is there a class of people, a group of people that you struggle to relate to because you so don't understand them, so don't align with them in thinking, that you don't even know how to relate to them? You think of a group of people like that? I think we all have them. I've shared with you some of the groups of people that I sometimes struggle relating to. I just don't even understand the mechanics of beginning the relationship. Well, in a way, that's where these guys are. And so they're complaining to themselves, this man receives sinners and eats with them. And so Jesus starts to explain some things to them about where God's heart is. So he told them this parable, what man of you having 100 sheep, if he had lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? When he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, rejoice with me, for I have found the sheep that was lost. And when you hear that, what's the assumption that he's asking them to buy into? Anybody? What is the assumption that Jesus is asking them to buy into? Not only that, yes, I suppose that's one of the assumptions. Here's the primary assumption that he's calling them to think about. Remember, his objective is to change their beliefs. If he can't change their beliefs, then the stories are just entertaining, right? Do you picture Jesus showing up on earth just to be amusing? I mean, maybe he could be a great comedian, but I don't think that was his mission here. So, the assumption that he hopes that they're going to gain is that the one sheep is of great value. Let me put it to you a different way. What idiot would abandon 99 healthy sheep to go look for one that was useless? And let's be honest, it's a rebellious sheep. It's the one sheep that just won't stay home at nights. What's up with this sheep? Right?
Let me pose that a different way. Each one of your 99 sheep is worth $100,000. But there's one that wandered off. And you know there are open fields here. I can see them from all points of view. I know there are no wolves here. Relatively safe. But that other one couldn't have got far. Couldn't have got far. He's just probably over here somewhere. You know, lost for a second. Or maybe, like you said, eating something. I'll bet I can get him quick. Like we all. But it's $100,000. It's the whole tithe thing. Well, if you put a couple of dollars in the plate, that doesn't hurt. I'll throw 10, 20, 50, 100, 1,000. Imagine Warren Buffett throwing 100,000 a week in that plate. Ooh, now it starts to, what is that value? I mean, we can do that, but what is the value?
Well, and in the minds of the Pharisees, what is the value? Their question is, don't we have enough good people in here? Why do we have to go chase after the bad people? And what would we do with them even if we got them? Why would we want them? We're okay right the way we are. And so when we're honest, we have to admit that at times the gospel message is an offense to us because it invites into the kingdom people that we don't even like.
So even in that, Jesus is addressing a religious spirit. He's radical
for
that, you're saying.
Shepherd didn't ask the sheep if they liked him. They didn't ask the sheep if they even wanted him in the herd.
And here's the amazing part. The shepherd doesn't come back, it says, dragging the sheep by the cuff of the neck and saying, "You idiot moron sheep, if you ever run away again." It's a picture of kind of a love that the shepherd has for the sheep. Throws it over their shoulders, carries it back to the flock. And then invites the other people, probably shepherds, to say, "Hey, I got my sheep back. Isn't that great news?" And then he goes on to the next story. And remember, the purpose to each of these stories is to help them think about the way they think about the kingdom. Because here's the important part that we need to remember at this point. The invitation of the gospel is both personal and communal. You are not only being invited to be, and this is the mistake of 21st or 20th century, probably 19th century, it begins, westernized gospel. It's very personalized. Wouldn't you like to have a personal relationship with God through Jesus Christ? That's really not the message. The message is, wouldn't you like to become part of a family? And the Pharisee's answer at this moment is, no, not really. We're happy with what we've got over here. Or what woman, having 10 coins, if she loses one, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it? When she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost." And just so I tell you, there is joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents. So now he moves from sheep to coins, but then he draws the connection, he draws the link. The coin is like a person, and God rejoices when people are restored. So what's he calling them to actually reflect on in their own lives? Would any of us actually rejoice if the person that we liked least repented and became part of the kingdom? This is more personal. This is as personal for us as it is for them. Because when we're honest, we know there are people that we struggle to like. There are people that we would rather, it would be okay if they were in the kingdom at large, right? But they could be in the kingdom at large, say in Sellersville or Perkasie or perhaps Lancaster County, just to play it safe so that our paths never crossed. You know what I'm saying? Don't look at me like you don't understand.
Oh, I understand. My mind's running.
The message has been so convoluted through prosperity preaching and name and claim it garbage and all of this other crap that people have tried to quote unquote preach to people over the years. The message is salvation. And like I said the other week, isn't heaven enough? Isn't that enough? What do you, I can hear God actually saying to people, what do you want from me? What do you expect? Well, you know, stop.
We tried to help God out and make this gospel attractive. That's what we've done.
Yeah.
And we polluted it. That's what we've done with the gospel.
I think it's funny that not only did Jesus preach about, like here in the passage you just read, not only is he saying, you know, I'm accepting the things that you rejected, but he's also teaching about, like, things that the religious leaders probably haven't been tasting. Sheep are stupid, dirty, nasty creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Our kids in the class are making little puff cotton balls. They're not like they're like if shepherds would not scrub the back end of sheep, they would die because their poop clogs up their fur. Like them, that's how stupid they are. And then he was teaching about women in the house. Well, religious leaders didn't care about women. They were like the dregs of society. They were just possessions. And I think it's funny that Jesus is using that in the scripture, or in his teaching, to be like, look, all these things that you put up to the side, I'm using these as an example.
Mm-hmm. But
well, that's what Jesus is
doing. Yeah.
He's using those examples as us as people. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And finally, where we're headed with this, and he said, there was a man who had two sons. Now, have you have any doubt about the fact that this is a contrived story, and it's a contrived story with an intended purpose? It's just amazing that the man has only two sons. There's no mention of any other family. There's no mention of a third son. There are two sons.
There were daughters, so you don't have.
So from the beginning, but Jesus is telling the story, so he wouldn't have, John. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the property that is coming to me, and he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. Okay, so we're good so far. So now let's come back to these words on the paper: reach, reconcile, restore, refine. So the first question is, in what method does the gospel use to reach people? And there's a number of methods. So we're going to look at how does the gospel reach this guy? If we say that this is a comparison story between the love of God that is intended to connect with people, what is it about God that connects with this son? So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of the country, this is after he ran out of money, and sent him into the fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and I will say, and we'll put a pause right there, what is it that finally turns his thinking? What does he discover about his father for the first time that he admires now, and he probably hated before?
We all said it one time. Dad was right.
Servants were.
Here's what I believe he discovers. My dad is a righteous man. Before, I didn't appreciate what righteous meant. My dad is such a righteous man that he will hire people who maybe aren't even worthy to be hired. He will hire people simply so they can eat. As a matter of fact, I believe that in the back of the son's mind, if you want to build this story out a little bit more, here's a guy who is thinking to himself, if I don't get my money now, that idiot old man of mine is going to give all of what could be my money away to people who need a job just so they can eat. So I better get in while the getting is good before this guy gives it all away. But for the first time in his life, he finds himself where? In the position of the very people that he knows that his righteous dad would care about. So he doesn't return home because he's convinced that he's going to return home to a father. Who is he first drawn to? My father is a righteous man. And the son defines righteousness as caring for the needs of those who have no way to care for themselves anymore.
He didn't think he was going to go back to his former status. My dad's benevolent. He'll be You'll be
good. Well, so many people struggle just with that. Well, I don't want to get saved just to be a servant. I want to get saved to be a king. Jesus, and I came to serve, not to be served. You can call me king, okay, great. But I came to serve.
And what is the breaking point there? The breaking point there in the son's life is what? I have finally come to the point where I have no resources other than my own. This is going to be critical when we look at living faith in just a moment. I'm no longer worthy to be called, and this is the speech he rehearses, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. So there we get to from reach. So first, now the son has been reached. In this case, the son has been reached by the character of his father. The hug is reconciliation. There's a reconnection of the relationship that was thoroughly broken and damaged. At least one-sided. Then there's restoration. Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand, and shoes on his feet, and bring the fatted calf and kill it. And let us eat and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and now is found. So he's been restored to a position, not of a servant, but what? Of a son. He's been restored to the one thing that he thought he could never attain to again. And then we have to have the reality of the gospel. These first three are very attractive and they happen very quickly. The gospel reaches a person. It may take years, but once the reach is made, the person moves in a different direction. We'd call that repentance. The son actually turns. He acts on what he understands. He's restored. But now these last three, refine, repurpose, and refill, they take a while. Now this is the part of the story that if we were to make this a living story and not just a parable, we'd have to be honest about. And this is the furthering of the gospel message. The gospel message doesn't just take you to relationship. It repurposes and refits your life and calls you into a refined purpose for a new relationship. Hold that thought and let's go back to Ephesians.
With this, salvation, the gospel, with this and nothing else. Just those five books. Because that was a challenge. You know what I mean? It was attractive, I think, because they didn't really have anything. They didn't really have anything. You're right. The rich were so wealthy that nobody could even imagine that. And then there was no real middle class. Then you had everybody else.
But I think here is what happened. It's the same thing that happens in the church today. We assume that the gospel message is only for a certain kind of people. To answer your question, okay, you're going to take me on one detour. One detour and one detour only. Let me see if I can find this quickly. No, we're going to because it was a good question. The only challenge will be, can I find the answer scripturally? No.
Okay.
Here we are, Matthew 5th chapter 13th verse. You are the salt of the earth, but the salt has lost its taste. How shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket. Who is that message directed toward? First century Jewish people that Jesus was talking to. What was Jesus saying? God's original plan was to use you as the prototype to demonstrate His love so that the rest of the world would be drawn to it. You so botched your job that people are repulsed by religion, not drawn toward the love of the Father. You so missed mission that we've got to establish a new mission. It's there throughout the Old Testament. And all Jesus did was remind them of what they should have known. They were called to love their enemies. They were called, as a matter of fact, in certain times when enemies of Israel were in a disadvantageous position and they were threatened with death, God stepped in and said, no, through His prophet, you do not kill them. You feed them and you send them home.
Well, that was Jonah's big problem. That's why you don't want to go to Nineveh. They need to be wiped out. They should be killed. They deserve to die. I don't want to go there and preach repentance and they can be forgiven and come to you now.
Right, and that is the hard part for him. I know you. You're sending all of the creation. I'm going to spend my waste my time, talent, and energy going to do this. And you're going to do this anyway. I know you. Why bother even sending me? Because without a voice, without me, they're going to tell them there's stuff there. At least one needs to go and tell. Maybe we can live with that.
Okay. Back to Ephesians. So are we clear on that? The message is front to back. It's clear. It's there.
Yeah, Moses pointed toward the Messiah, the Savior, someone who comes to all the prophets. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll start at the beginning of the second chapter in Ephesians. And you were dead in trespasses and sin, in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air. The spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience. Okay, so far it sounds like an us and them. But in the next few words, Paul introduces himself into the story, among whom we all once lived, in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath. So what he's saying is, here's the gospel message. It's not that some of us were good and some of us weren't good, and so the good ones have been sent out to invite the bad ones. The message of the gospel is that we're all the bad ones. God showed favor on some, has restored some, and now we are repurposed and refitted. The gospel message is not complete until those who have received the message become the messengers. That's when the gospel message comes full circle. Until you are a messenger, the gospel has not been fully realized in your life. But God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love which He loved us with, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved and raised up. Now, isn't it great here? The way Paul makes sure that nobody feels like they're exempt. Because when he describes this, and we'll jump back up to the part that I already read, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body. And so you can immediately see people going to, that's right, there's those adulterers over there and those fornicators over there and there's the people who kill and rob and steal and cheat. But before they can get into full mental stride and break out into a full mental run, he says, and the mind. Well, maybe you didn't actually carry out that adultery, but did you think about it? Maybe you didn't actually take your fist and pound that guy square in the face, but do you really wish you had the opportunity and wouldn't have gotten caught? See,
I don't want to get caught as long as I don't go to. And before I put in the big book of AA, there's a certain part of that, and talk about those who don't get it. Says there are those few unfortunates who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. It's not their fault. They seem to have been born that way. There are other people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm fine. I'm good. I don't do that. I'm sure as heck don't do that. I'm a good person. Okay.
Mark, Luke, and John, and then Paul, and all the letters referring back to this one incident where I don't know the cost to the next person that I look at. Excuse me, I don't know the value that next person I look at has in the kingdom or to the Heavenly Father, but I know the cost it takes for that person to be reconciled to God. Is that cost enough for me as a believer to motivate me to step aside from all those things that causes I'm not ashamed of it, that I'm going to share, not because I understand the value, but because I know the cost?
We're actually going to, I hope, if we... Yeah, we got time. We're going to get there. We're going to explore that. I think we're going to explore something that helps us all to see that. All right. For every grace you have been saved and raised up with Him, seated with Him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus, so that in the coming age He might show the immeasurable riches of His grace in kindness towards us. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not of your own doing. It is the gift of God, not the result of works, so that no one may boast. And now it gets to the next part of the story. For we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus, for good works which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Now, if He's just teaching, that's just one thing. That's just an interesting phrase. But if interwoven in here is a degree of personal testimony, then He's sharing with His readers what He's discovered about the process of the gospel. That is, the gospel message does not end when I am reconciled, when I'm restored. The gospel message continues on until I am repurposed for the good works that I've been called to and refilled with what it takes in order to fulfill those good works. Turn over to chapter 3, the 7th verse. And he unpacks this a little bit more fully. Of this gospel I was made a minister, according to the gift of God's grace, which was given me by the working of His power. To me, though I am the very least of all the saints, this grace was given to me to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ, and to bring to light for everyone what is the plan of the mystery hidden for the ages. All right, so what he says... Now he's really getting what appears to perhaps be personal testimony in chapter 2 becomes full-blown testimony in chapter 3, where he confirms and validates what he said in a general sense in chapter 2. This is what I have experienced in the gospel. The very call in my life is not just a call to relationship. It is a call to assist God in being part of reconciling others to Himself. So let's come back and let's look at this faith thing. And it's on your page, so we'll just look at the page. I may not draw pretty pictures on the board there. So God's grace is common in both of these first formulas. So for the moment, we'll just scratch them out so we're not distracted by them. We take them for granted. So for the moment, we're going to take them for granted. The two views of justification, in other words, my being made right with God, my faith plus my works, equals my justification. So turn over to James, the second chapter, just so we can see this. So if you come out of a Catholic background, you may appreciate this a little bit, where there is an emphasis on both faith and works. And it seems if you read James, that James almost talks about that. And a lot of people, I think, this is my opinion anyway, that some people teach this text really badly. So we're going to look at this, the second chapter, starting at the 14th verse. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith, but he does not have works? Well, now that sounds suspiciously like formula number one, that I need faith and I also need works, because if I have one but I don't have the other, then I'm not justified. Can that faith save him? If a brother or a sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to him, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So if you were to stop reading right there, what would it seem as if James is saying?
Your faith is pointless if you don't prove it through your actions.
Okay. Your faith needs to be proved. There's something needs to be added to your faith is one possible way to interpret it. Many people believe that. My faith plus my works equals my justification. But that's not what Paul describes in the second chapter of Ephesians that we just read. Paul's formula is my faith equals my justification plus my works. It's just a simple movement of where the equal sign is and where the plus sign goes. So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Okay, so when you read the first two sentences, it seems as if he's saying you need faith plus works. These two words, so also, help us to understand that this sentence is an illustration. And that's all it is. And so what he's saying is, if you were to wish on this person who was cold and hungry, if you were to wish on them warmth and sustenance, but didn't go out and do anything about it, what good would it be to them? It would serve no purpose to them. They'd gain nothing from it. It didn't mean that you didn't have warm, fuzzy feelings for them. It doesn't negate the warm, fuzzy feelings that you have. But from their perspective, it's useless. So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. And so here's what he's saying. If your faith does not produce any works, you should be suspicious about your faith. It's not that you should be suspicious about salvation. You should be suspicious about what kind of faith you have. We'll get into that in a little bit more in just a minute. But someone will say, well, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that God is one and you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. All right. So we're going to look at the three components of what we call a living faith. So we got knowledge at the top. Did I spell that right? Guess so. What is the knowledge component of faith?
That's true. Yeah, I'm disconnected from God. I do know Him through Christ. I have this relationship now with Him. I've been restored.
Okay. There is a knowledge component. But let me back up and introduce to you a different idea that at first may seem offensive, but I think you'll appreciate it after a while. We all have a living faith. Even if you don't believe in God, you have a living faith. Everyone has a living faith. It's the matter of what is the object of your living faith. Okay, so we have a knowing. So I have to know a collection of ideas. I have to be introduced to them. Hence, where Paul says, how blessed are the feet of those who bring the gospel. Because he says what? If somebody doesn't tell you, you can't know. And until you know, you can't believe. Right? So after we know, we have a collection of that, then we have to decide what we believe. Does this seem credible? Does it seem as if I could rest my life on it? But then we get into the final part where I have to act. These two are the demons guys. Right? They have a body of knowledge, and it says that they believe. But until the belief is transferred into action of some sort, the faith is worthless. And that's really what James is saying. If your faith is not producing anything, then it's probably not faith because you probably don't really believe it. If you believed, if you genuinely believed that I had $1 million in my pocket, let me clarify, that would not be true. But if I were to make that claim and you were to believe it and I were also to say to you, and I will give that $1 million to the first person who asks me, John has living faith at that moment because he's going to act on it. Let me show you this. You see, the faith was active along with his works. And he's talking about Abram. And the scripture was fulfilled. It says, Abram believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness. What was counted to him as righteousness? He says, was not Abram our father justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? Now here's the interesting thing about the $1 million, and we'll compare it to that. What is the likelihood that I really have $1 million in my pocket?
Zero.
Right, or I probably wouldn't be here this morning. But if I could compel John to believe it, and if John for some reason had enough history with me that he actually believed that I would not tell a lie of that magnitude, at least, and John were to be convinced that it was worth, that I would give it to him, then he takes the step. And what James is saying is, how unlikely is it to the person who is outside of relationship to place themselves in Abram's position with Isaac? How genuinely likely is that, that a man is going to take his son to the mountain saying all the while God is going to provide an alternate sacrifice? And this is what James is saying. This is what constitutes living faith.
It goes back to what you said earlier in these weeks about the friendship aspect. And he said that Abraham was a friend of God. He knew him. He trusted him. He acted on his belief in God.
And so what James is really saying is you can tell your faith by what you do. It's not that you need to add the doing to your faith to get something. What he's saying is you can really tell whether you believe this or not by whether you live it. If you don't live it, you probably don't believe it. And if you don't believe it, you probably have not placed your faith fully in God. All right, so we move down to the next block there. So we all start out with love of self being very large in our lives, and love of God being either non-existent or extremely small. So now we'll go back up to the story of the prodigal son. So the day the son goes to dad and says, "Give me my cut, pops," what's his love of self and what's his love of God? How would those boxes look? I would venture to say that the top box on the left wouldn't even exist. There was only one box. It was the bottom box on the left. It was completely filled with the love of self. It took a catalyzing event for the son to even consider. Now, at first, how much love of self and how much love of God is there? Let's be honest. What is one of the motivators that compels the son to go home? Love of self. And incidentally, that is sometimes what draws us into the kingdom. Love of self will sometimes draw us into the kingdom. Why? We're afraid of something or we want to get something, and so we're compelled to turn from whatever we were living for, and we're compelled to turn toward God. But at least at that moment, what's happened? We've acquired a certain, we'll call it, respect for God. I believe that God is a righteous God and He will do certain things. And just like the son, I'm not sure I'm ever going to get to be restored to sonship again, but at least I count on God being righteous and He will do certain things that He's promised to do. But gradually, and this is the story of the repurposing, the day the son comes home, he has the banquet, he gets the nice clothes, he doesn't smell like he's been with the pigs anymore. Do all his fond memories of his time away dissipate immediately? Think about that. See, the day he comes home, he's hungry, he's broke, and he's filthy. That memory is the one that is firmly etched in the forefront of his thinking. It's not hard to embrace God then. It's not hard at that moment. A week later, when he's thinking about the peak of his time of enjoyment, when it was fun to wake up next to a different woman every morning, or it was fun to have a party with 50 of your closest friends and have all the money you wanted, do all those memories slip away immediately? And so there's a gradual transition that takes place between where love of self is displaced with a love of God. Now here's where this is particularly And if we can make this case with people, perhaps, and if we can really understand what's taking place in our own lives, perhaps we can appreciate the gospel more fully. When love of self is my primary objective, I'm both the object of my love and the subject of my love. So in other words, all of my attention is focused on who? Me, right? But who is the one who has to focus his attention on me? Me. It's an exhausting job. I love me. I am the object of all of my attention. But I also have to serve myself. What's wrong with that? Well, here's what's wrong with it. On a good day, it's easy to love yourself. Think of the day that you liked yourself most. It's easy to love yourself on that day. Have you ever had a day when you despised yourself? Have you ever had a day when you were so disappointed with yourself, so frustrated, so loathed yourself because of who you were, what you've done, or whatever? If self-love is all you have, how difficult is it to be the subject, in other words, to have to administer that love, when you know that the object is not worthy of your love? But when we take and we supplant that with love of God, we know that now God becomes the object. We still the subject.
And it's sustained. He loves us when we're unlovable, no matter what. He keeps loving us.
The only difference is, in this package, who's there? Me. This is it. In this package, there's God and me. And it is mutual love. And then it becomes love expressed toward others. Let's turn over to Proverbs 10:22. This is just a really short verse, but I think it kind of like highlights what we want to see here. Actually, if somebody already has that, because I hear some people's pages stop flipping. Does anybody have that?
The blessing of the Lord makes one rich and he adds no sorrow with it.
Yeah, that's it. Have you ever tried to bless yourself?
Yeah. We try that all the time.
Well, don't we?
Yeah.
And what happens when we bless ourselves? Have you ever blessed yourself into credit card oblivion? Did you say, is that wrong?
Yeah.
You'll know at the end of 30 days, my friend.
We do that along with it, too. Is that wrong? Well, if I knew that was wrong, you know, let's do it.
So this is the process that the gospel message invites us into. It is a gradual transition where we come to understand who we really are. And I don't really fully appreciate who I am until the love of God comes to reside in me. Because when I am both object and subject of my love, I am trying to prop up my fragile self-esteem when deep down inside I know I can't be propped up. Because I am also the valuer of the currency that I hold dear. And the currency fluctuates daily. The value of that currency fluctuates daily because I'm determining my own self-worth and yet I know what I'm really worth. But when God is the valuer of my currency, which means my worth, then every day I can wake up and I can live confidently in the fact that I'm the sheep that he came and chased down. I'm the coin that he wouldn't stop looking for. I'm the sun that he watched for every day, scanning the horizon to see if today was the day that I would come home. And so every day, no matter how difficult life is, I can wake up with that knowledge. Yes?
I think, and even now, I'm standing here going, well, that in itself makes me depressed
Sorry, I did my best there.
You still look at that, and you know, I can still look at that and say, well, you know, I'm the sheep that ran away. You know, I'm the coin that got lost. But I think, you know, if you think about it, you can realize with that thought process, you can still see, just using that, how much self-love you still have. Because if your focus is towards self again, you're going to see what you've done. You're going to see who you are. Versus if you are having God love as opposed to self love, you're not going to see yourself anymore. You're just going to see what He does and who He is, and yourself and what you've done, and why He loves you and what you don't deserve slips out of the equation. So that's an interesting little diagnosis tool there.
That's why it has to start with God. As you said, this whole quest, this whole journey scenario starts with God, and we won't understand or appreciate the value of human life unless we start with God himself. We can appreciate the worth and value of human beings for ourselves. That we are, there's a God, we're created in His image, and then that's where that starts, this whole thing we're talking about.
So gradually, even the faith component, the living faith. And I hope by now you can appreciate that we all have living faith. Because if I trust in myself, some people wake up every day and who's the primary object of their faith? Themselves. If I trust myself, I have a living faith in myself. Gradually, I transition to a living faith in God. And I say gradually because in the same way that there is this gradual displacement that takes place where every day, hopefully, a little more of the love of God and the love for God infiltrates me as a vessel, and a little less of the unadulterated love of self lives inside of me. Every day that there is a little bit more displaced, there's a little bit more ability to have an active and living faith expressed toward God. Do you understand what I just said? So go ahead.
So when we love self, in essence, we are our own God.
Well, yes.
And so that's a faulty God. That's not a good enough God, you know. And that's where all this frustration can come from, as you're saying.
So here's the thing. We don't beat ourselves up when our faith isn't tremendous at first. We can't beat ourselves up over it. Why? Because we're filled mostly still. On the day that the Son comes home, who is He primarily filled with yet?
Still Himself.
Sure He is. It's a long process before He is integrated back into the family, finds His purpose, finds how He fits into family now that He's restored, because He's a different person. He now has a different story. He's left the ranch.
From that moment, though, He's accepted by the Father from the Father's perspective. But at His side, it's this transition.
And there is an honest dynamic that takes place here where it's like sometimes the rest of family, or what should be our family, doesn't seem to accept us, and that's a process. So we shouldn't be surprised at the fact that that is a process. Even in the church, it's going to be a process. So I don't think that until the Pharisees became belligerently hostile, I don't think Jesus was opposed to them. He wanted to help them understand. Remember what we said, the gospel is not just for those like us, it is for those who are not like us and for those we don't even like. And we don't know how to relate to those that we don't like. The Pharisees don't really know how to relate to these people. They don't understand them.
And Jesus' heart was breaking for the Pharisees, and we see how harsh He was, but simple things like you healed on the Sabbath, Jesus, and He's trying to bring out the point James made all those years later. Here's your faith. Well, here it is practically displayed, and you're not getting it. It's hard work for them. They knew all this knowledge, but yet they weren't putting it into practice.
Okay, so we'll turn over to Acts 9. We're not going to spend a lot of time with this. Remember where we left off in Ephesians 3, where Paul says that he was called specifically. This is part of his story. That the method of the gospel is that it reaches us, it reconciles us, it restores us, it refines us, and that's a process. The first three happen pretty quickly, but then it refines us, it repurposes us, and it refills us. So while you're all turning to Acts 9, I want to talk for just a moment about those two final ones, repurpose and refill. If you are repurposed but not refilled, you have a message or you have an ambassadorship, we'll say, but you don't have any love. So until God's love infiltrates your heart to the point that you can relax in it and rest in it and enjoy the relationship, what do you have to give? You have an interesting story, but no love behind it. Just think about that. If you are repurposed but not refilled, you have a message to deliver, but you don't even know why you love and enjoy this God whose message you are delivering. And so if you're not being regularly refilled with a love, in other words, if you're not being refreshed, if you don't enjoy the relationship, then what kind of ambassador are you? Wouldn't you like to come be miserable just like I am? That's essentially, and don't you know people that are like that? Wouldn't you like to be rules bound just like I am? Wouldn't you like to be all uptight just like I am? Wouldn't you like to always be judging other people just like I am? That might not be the words that you use, but that's what people see. And so unless you are refilled regularly, refreshed, so that you can just honestly relax in this relationship and say, this is good, I enjoy this, then you don't have anything to offer. Chapter 9. But Paul was still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord. And he went to the high priest and asked them for letters to the synagogues of Damascus so that it was found any belonging to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. Now as he went on his way, he approached Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven shone around him, and falling on the ground, he heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? How many times have you read that? Once, 20, 30, 40 times? How many times have you heard it preached on? What should Jesus say? Why are you persecuting? What does Jesus say? Why are you persecuting me? Have you ever really stopped and meditated on that? He doesn't say, why are you persecuting all these people? Who's Saul on his way to get? He's on his way to get Jesus? Jesus is not even in the equation, except that he's this annoying inconvenience, this originator, this pioneer of the way. He's this guy who's dead, who just won't go away. And there's all these weirdos who keep following him and they get in the way of true religion. So once again, I got to leave town and I got to go get some more of these guys and bring them back to town. And Jesus shows up and Jesus doesn't say, why are you persecuting them? What does he say? Why are you persecuting me? Isn't that refreshing? Kind of. It's both good news and it's bad news, because what does it say when we do not demonstrate kindness and hospitality to those that we're called to serve? Listen, I don't like hearing this, because what it's saying is, oh, so I'm persecuting God when I'm persecuting others? Who wants to be opposed to God today? Show of hands. Who wants to set themselves up and be persecuting Jesus today? But he gives them another chance. And he said, who are you, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus. And just for double emphasis here, whom you are persecuting. Let's make it very clear. Why are you persecuting me? I'm Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But rise and enter the city, and you'll be told what to do. The men who were traveling with him stood speechless, hearing the voices, but seeing no one. So Saul rose from the ground, and although his eyes were open, he saw nothing. So they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. Isn't this interesting? So the man who was going to take captives is himself taken captive by the message of the gospel and is bound up in a place to think about the gospel message for several days. He who is going to bind others finds himself bound, made captive, so that he can meditate on what he's doing. Now there was a disciple at Damascus named Ananias, and the Lord said to him in a vision, Ananias, and he said, here I am, Lord. And the Lord said to him, rise and go to the street called Straight, at the house of Judas, look for the man of Tarsus named Saul, for behold, he is praying. And he has seen a vision of a man named Ananias coming in and laying hands on him so that he might regain his sight. But Ananias answered, Lord, I've heard about from many about this man, how much evil he has done to your saints at Jerusalem. And here he has authority from the chief priest to bind all who call on your name. But the Lord said to him, go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to carry my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. For I will show him how much he must suffer for the sake of my name. Do you see what Paul sees his vision as? Now this is Luke writing this. In just a minute or two, if we have the time, we're going to go and we're going to look at it through Paul's own words. God's vision for the gospel is far bigger than ours. I don't know if we can fully grasp that or get that through our heads, but God's vision for this message and the power of this message and the purpose of this message is always much bigger than ours. Peter struggled with it. Paul struggled with it. Incidentally, here's the way I heard it worded just this past week. And it regarded the idea of living faith. He said, we probably do not truly believe what we say we believe to the extent that we say we believe it. Because it's pretty evident that a few guys back then truly believed what they said they believed, and they acted every day according to what they believed, and look at what they did. We have millions of people today who say they believe, and yet what's our impact? A few people, comparatively amazingly few. Like if you were to draw a graph and here was all population up here and here were the followers of the way who are authentic believers. What was their influence on those in the entire Mediterranean basin? It was profound given the number of people that there were. So if you want to look at our living faith, how alive and active and dynamic is it? Because how much influence do we really have? And so this is what was said. He said, truthfully, every day we struggle with whether we really believe what we say we believe. And we're not quite 100% sold out to the fact that what we say we believe, we really do believe. Because if we really, really believed it the way we claim to believe it, our lives would probably look so much different that we couldn't help but have more of an influence on the world around us. It's a displacement issue. And the good news is, just the same as we can allow more of the love of God to displace the love of self, we can allow more of the confidence of what we say we believe to displace the doubt that we have. But it's a process. So now we turn over to Acts 24. It occurs to me right about now that I've probably done most of the talking for the morning. Did anybody else have anything to say besides me?
Jimmy didn't get
most. Fair enough, but Jimmy's gone. Jimmy always has something to say. All right. We'll start at the beginning of chapter 24. So after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and the spokesman Tertullus, and they laid before the governor their case against Paul. And when he had summoned Tertullus, began to accuse him, saying, and they go into all the accusations against Paul. All right, so we're going to jump down to verse 22. So you know most of this story, but now Paul is really in a place where he finds himself. He had every capability all the way along in this narrative up to there to get out of this position that he finds himself in. Person after person, when he was on his return trip to Jerusalem, from which he ends up in this difficult situation, person after person along the way prophesied to him and said, you are going to find yourself in a difficult situation. You're going to find yourself bound if you go back to Jerusalem. And what did they do? They pleaded with him, don't go to Jerusalem. And he said, no, I feel God's called me to go to Jerusalem. I have to go to Jerusalem. I'm compelled to go to Jerusalem. What individual would go to their own death unless they really, really strongly believed in what they said they believed in? And this is what I'm saying that I believe that fellow said that I heard this week. That we truly don't really believe what we claim we believe to the depth that we claim we believe it, or our lives would look different. But Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, "When Lysias the tribune comes down, I will decide your case." That's Paul's case. Then he gave orders to the centurion that he should be kept in custody, but have some liberty. After some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, and sent for Paul, and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And he reasoned about righteousness and self-control and the coming judgment. Now Felix had an opportunity, having heard all this. This could have been the catalytic moment in Felix's life. What's Felix's response? "When I get the opportunity, I will summon you again." Because it says Felix was alarmed and said, "Go away for the present time." So this is the stumbling block that we face as ambassadors. Most of us, when we face that stumbling block once or twice, we quit. It's amazing. Paul, it seems to be, if you were to put it in modern terms, Paul seems to be too stupid to understand no when he hears it. He keeps coming back with the same message again and again. Why? Why? Come on. Because that's his story. How many times did he say no? How many evidences did Paul see that this way was real? That this Jesus was true, and yet he denied it and blindly went on persecuting those very people? What did it take for Paul to have a breakthrough? Why do you think Paul has such compassion and keeps on bringing the message? It took Jesus himself showing up for Paul to have a breakthrough. Can you imagine what Paul's thinking? He's probably thinking to himself, "My word, if it took that in my life, what's it going to take for people who don't have that?" And so he continues to deliver and deliver in different ways, knowing that it is so hard. Remember what we said last week about the gospel message and the stumbling block that people find in their way, that once I form a set of beliefs, I filter everything I see through those beliefs and interpret it according to what I already believe. So it's very difficult for a person to acquire new beliefs, because once they've acquired existing beliefs, they filter everything through what they already say they believe, and therefore they interpret everything they see and align it with their current beliefs. And they somehow filter out everything that doesn't match what they say they already believe. Let's just turn over so we get to this point. And now I want to wrap up with Paul's story in his own words. So we'll turn over to chapter 26. This is a really great story. I wish I had some more time to teach on this, but I don't. So Agrippa said to Paul, so Agrippa is King Herod's son, who had been a leader in Jerusalem, but he'd been displaced from that role and was now a leader in northern territories, and he comes to visit. And so Agrippa said to Paul, "You have permission to speak for yourself." And then Paul stretched out his hand and made his defense. "I consider myself fortunate that before you, King Agrippa, I'm going to make my defense today against all the accusations of the Jews." And so here he begins. "My manner of life from my youth, spent from the beginning among my own nation and in Jerusalem, is known to all the Jews. They have known for a long time, if they are willing to testify, that according to the strictest party of our religion, I have lived as a Pharisee. So this is my story. I've been pure, I've been right, I've been the elite of the elite. This is my background, and now I stand here on trial because of my hope and the promise made by God to our fathers, to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly worship night and day." Now, interestingly, he references the 12 tribes. Again, we come back to the fact that the gospel is a message that brings unity to diversity. The gospel never asks you, the invitation of the gospel is never to divest yourself of who you are as an individual and get lost in a mass amalgam. It is always an invitation to bring your uniqueness and have your uniqueness exist within the unity of diversity. Does that make sense? You don't get lost in the gospel. I remember struggling with that for years. I would have to become like everybody else. I would have to think like everybody else. wouldn't necessarily have to look like everybody else, but I might have to dress like them. And there were all these things of I had to become like. And I'm telling you, I really resisted that for a long time because there was something in me that just said, I don't want to be like that. The gospel invites you, as you are, to come be a partaker in unity, but not give up your uniqueness. All right, so where all do we want to go? Okay, so we'll go to verse 12. In this connection, I journeyed to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priests. And at midday, O king, I saw on the way a light from heaven, brighter than the sun that shone around me, and those who journeyed with me. In other words, everybody saw it. And when we had all fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in the Hebrew language. He's very specific here. More specific than Luke is, because now Luke is not telling the story. Paul is telling his own story. Saul, why are you persecuting me? Again, that's there. It's hard for you to kick against the goats. And so Jesus really understands. This is part of the story. Jesus is saying, it's really hard for you to keep doing this, isn't it? Is there something going on inside of you? Are you wrestling with something inside of yourself, Paul? And I said, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. But rise and stand up upon your feet. For I have appeared to you for this purpose, to appoint you as a servant and a witness to the things which you have seen in me and those in which I will appear to you. So here's his promise that day. I want you to talk about the experience that you had today, but you are going to have more experiences, and those experiences are going to equip you to talk about still further things. So the invitation of the gospel is not just a static invitation to tell about what Jesus did for you on day one. The invitation of the gospel is the promise of God that He is inviting you into a journey which is going to give you new stories to tell about Him every day. But only if you continue to walk that way. Okay, where are we? For I have appeared to you for this purpose, to appoint you as a servant and a witness to the things in which you have seen me, and to those in which I will appear to you, delivering you from your people and from the Gentiles. And so what is his story? His story is again and again, when I should have died, when I should have been in prison and executed, again and again God showed up and delivered me. Now, you have to admit that unless Paul really believed that there was a hope for the future, he should really have abandoned this. Because what idiot wants to be pulled out of one prison just so he can find himself in a different town in a different prison with a different set of stones? I mean, I guess the stones in each different region of the country look different and they're pretty, and you could get stoned by red stones one month and you could get stoned by orange stones the next month. But what fool wants to get out of one prison just so he can go to the next? And yet this is Paul's story, and he wants to make it clear to people, God delivers me, but I don't take advantage of that because I have a passion to continue to deliver this message. All right. In which I will appear to you, delivering you from your people and from the Gentiles to whom I am sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. And so the final component of his story is Paul saying to them, I, Paul, a persecutor, have been sent to invite others who are now even persecuting me to become part of the kingdom. I, the former persecutor, now become an ambassador. I myself will be persecuted, but I will continue to invite people to partake of the very thing that I partake of, even though they persecute me the whole time I deliver the invitation. So that is the final resting point of the method of the gospel. Those of us who have received it, those who have partaken of it, those who are gradually experiencing a displacement of the love of self and a replacement instead of the love of God, of a growing living faith in God instead of a living faith in ourselves, we go out and we become the representatives of that message. And in all likelihood, it's not going to go well for us when we are representatives of the message. Because unlike the stories that a lot of people tell on Sunday morning when they stand up in front of people in church and tell about how they sit on it. Have you ever marveled at the number of people who write books who always are sitting on planes next to people, and in 30 seconds the people have received the gospel message and live happily ever after lives. How does that happen? I don't know about you, but when I attempt to deliver the gospel message, people look at me like I have two heads. And Paul's story suggests something similar, that it's not always an easy road. And so this is why I believe this guy said that if we truly believe what we say we believe, and we believed it with the intensity and passion that we claim to believe it, the worlds that each of us influences would look substantially different than they do.